the March 9th, 2005 meeting of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we will be involved with preliminary Phase 1 hearings relating to Senate Bill 5516, and we welcome Rocky King.
It's hard to get in here.
I know.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, member of the committee.
I got a personal one.
For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and I'll let Jan.
Jan Dean, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division.
And I'd also like to introduce, before we start, two staff members that are with me. You're sitting right behind me. Becky Frederick, who is the fiscal manager for the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And Nicole Shuba, who is a policy analyst for the Insurance Pool Governing Board. So if you ask questions that I get a little over my head on, either Nicole or Becky are sure to help me. Before you is a blue binder, and I just want to go through the index with you just briefly. So on page C of the index, to talk about the appendix, because as we go through this, if there are specific questions and you really would like some detailed information, included in this appendix, I think, is information, more information probably than what you want. But we do have in there a agency brief that is a very comprehensive look at the FIAT program. Our annual progress report is in there, the executive summary off of our web page. We also have a statistical package on FIOP and from enrollment to costs. One of the things we'll talk about today, Mr. Chair, I think, is the maintenance of effort requirement, and included in that appendix is a paper on the maintenance of effort. We have some information relative to health insurance mandates on the small employer certified plans, and an analysis of all the group health insurance mandates required by the Oregon Insurance Code. We also have some brochures on both the small employer health insurance plans and the Family Health Insurance Assistance Member Handbook. I think one of the questions that came up during the DHS hearings, and I think Representative Hanna may have been you that said, how does the system work? I'll go through that at an appropriate time, but if you want even really the detailed information, it's included again in that appendix. So with that as kind of just an overview of some materials that will be available to you, let me start on page one and really kind of go through the agency mission and how we're organized, some of the target groups, performance measures, the prioritized list, like all the things that you're going to be keenly interested in. First of all, the Insurance Pool Governing Board has really three major missions contained within their agency mission. First is to really assist Oregon small businesses and consumers in getting health insurance by doing three things. One, providing education, information, and outreach, and I'll give you some good examples of what we do. The second mission is to provide subsidies to help low-income Oregonians who have economic barriers to getting health insurance get a subsidy to get enrolled in a health insurance plan. And finally, based on House Bill 2537 last session, to provide health insurance benefit plans to uninsured small employers. Really, we have three kind of areas that we focus on and that you'll hear me talking about most of today. The FIOP mission, a little bit more specific to that, again on page one, is again to remove the economic barriers to purchasing private health insurance. And secondly, and the important part about FIOP, is building on the private health care system as opposed to a public health insurance model, really to build on the private health care system that exists today in both the employer and individual markets. If you turn to page two, just to briefly go over what our agency goals are, and I'll give you some examples of each one of these, and there are 10. And some we meet, and some we don't, and some we really need to do a better job, and some we're very happy with, and I can make reference to those. First of all is to assist uninsured Oregonians in obtaining health insurance for themselves and their families. we do that primarily through the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program and a program that we call the Agent Referral Program. Somebody calls us and says, I need help, I can't get health insurance, and we average right now about 3,000 calls a week. And if somebody needs help, we have a list of agents that have attended all of our training sessions over the last couple years that we can actually refer that individual to that knows, we know the public side as well as the private side of their health insurance options. The second one is to assist small businesses in offering health insurance to their employers. I'll get into this in more detail, but the last legislative session asked us to develop health insurance plans for uninsured small businesses. We've done that. It's effective March 1 of this year, and we hope to enroll and assist some uninsured businesses for the first time purchase health insurance. Strengthen partnerships with schools and community resource agencies to increase the number of uninsured children and families. To increase the number of insured children and families. To give you two examples of that, we went to Portland and worked with Kaiser Permanente and had a variety of meetings at, I think it was five or six different schools in some of the lower economic areas. And Kaiser has a plan offering insurance for uninsured children, irrespective of their economic situation. Along with the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program staff, we provided outreach during meetings held at these schools during the beginning of the school year so that some of the families in these lower economic areas could see what their options were for getting their kids covered. We worked with the hospital in John Day and the chamber in John Day and went over and did an event when they started school in September where we met with all the parents that were attending the meeting, set up booths to provide information again on insurance for those families whose children were uninsured. So we work real close with a lot of the different groups. The fourth is to expand the minority populations in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. We do provide information in Spanish, Russian, Vietnamese, and I think there's one other dialect. We have agents that are conversant in the different languages for some of the applicants. We also have staff in our own office that are able to speak Spanish. We have even a Russian staff person who can talk to people in their native language. So we think we'll show some statistics, but we think we've done a pretty good job in terms of the minority populations that have been enrolled in our programs. Next one, number five, is to enhance and expand community and stakeholder outreach in all trainings and regions of the state. Give an example of that. Over the last 30 days, we've been in 23 or 24 different cities providing information on the high-risk pool, Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, and the small employer health insurance plans. I think we've held about 28 sessions over the last 30, 35 days, and this is from Lakeview to Astoria, to La Grande, Ontario, to Coos Bay, to Gold Beach, as well as obviously the I-5 corridor. So we do a lot of community and outreach meetings. Number six was to maximize federal funds participation by using enhanced match rates wherever possible. We'll talk about this a little bit when we get into the budget, but we do through the Medicaid waiver utilize federal funds. They come to us as other funds so that we're able to use as many outside of the state dollars as we can in providing some of the services that we provide. The next is to further expand technologies to enhance...
Rocky. Mr. Chair? When you're talking about maximizing federal funds, what's the current match and what is the prognosis under the President's new budget for the long-term match?
Mr. Chair, the current match, I believe, is about $61.39 for Title 19, and for the Title 21 is $28.72, and the blended match rate
It's about 65%
federal funds or other funds and 35% state funds.
Okay, and second part of the question is with the kind of the winds shifting in Washington, D.C., what does it look like for ongoing matching?
Mr. Chair, as far as I know, at this time, there's nothing that has passed that would change those match rates. Obviously, there are some proposals to cut Medicaid and develop some savings. How that will impact us at this point, I just can't answer that question. I don't know.
Do you have anything to add, Mr. Britton?
Just one thing, just to clarify, Title 19 is Medicaid, and Title 21 is SCHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program.
Okay. The next goal of ours was to expand our technologies to enhance customer service and communication with stakeholders and the general public. We do that much like a lot of other agencies in terms of the web page and being able to download application and program information. But it goes beyond that, and it really has to do with some of the administrative costs that are incurred. We want to figure out ways that it's easier for the client to access, to get us information, for us to get them information. And although the web page and using the Internet is very nice, quite frankly, for many of these lower-income families, they don't have access in their homes to the computers and the Internet technology that most of us have access to. So this really isn't just the Internet, it's also the phone system, how people access us by phone. When you have five people answering the phone and you get an average of 3,000 calls a week, how do you keep people from being on hold? How do you get them to talk to the right people? We're looking at a variety of those different things around some of the technologies, hopefully to improve what we're doing now. The eighth item is to identify and implement outreach strategies facilitating the coordination of health insurance options for employers, families, individuals in the rural communities. Give you an example of that. Today or tomorrow, we're down in Grants Pass. We're working with the hospitals. We're working with Head Start. We're working with the chambers and actually having 11 to 7 o'clock get information about Health Insurance Day. It's centered around the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, but also the small employer health insurance programs that are implemented March 1st. We will put down there, we've got a hall, we'll work with the chamber, they're providing all the resources in terms of Xerox machines and tables and desks, and we've been working with the radio stations and the television to really bring people in to find out, so they can find out what some of their health insurance options are. We can actually do on-site eligibility, setting up tables where people can come through in a Xerox machine so they can make copies of the papers that they bring in. Those are the kinds of things that we do. We've done that in Springfield. We've done that in Dalles. We did that at John Day, I believe. And our next one, I think, is Lincoln City. So we try to do one a month where we go to one of the rural communities working with the chambers and the hospitals to try to get information about their health care and health benefit options to those families. The next one is to reduce administrative costs, and if there's one that I have not been successful at doing, and that's reducing the administrative costs. And that's primarily related to the fact that we've had to close intake, focus on group for a long time, and watch the population come down. Now that we're starting to see the growth in the program, our administrative costs, we think by the end of the biennium will be in line with where our objective is, which is about a 10 to 12%. And we'll talk about that when we get to some of the performance measures. That's been our biggest challenge when you're in a startup situation, is keeping those costs down, but at the same time trying to bring as many people onto the program as you can in a short period of time. The last goal is establish measures of customer service. We have basically four programs that we're responsible for. The only one that we've really implemented that is with the high-risk pool, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. We will be implementing a very similar program to with the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And let me kind of just share with you what we do. When somebody applies to the high-risk pool and is accepted, the first thing we do is send out a survey to find out really how they like that process at the beginning, what the problems were, what the barriers were, to help us really get input, not for how they like the program, but how do they like the process of getting into the program. And it's not just like, but it's really to identify for us, I think, some of the problems that they have. Then after they've been in the program for 6 months, they get a second survey that really asks questions about about the program? Have you been, all your questions have been answered? Were the materials helpful for you to manage it? Are you getting from us exactly what you want? And then the third survey we do is on anybody who's terminated from the program. We send out a survey to, and we get about a 30% response. It basically says, now that you're gone, what do you think we could have done better? Or what did we do well? And it's really open-ended, so people not only do little check marks, but we also allow them to write comments to us about the benefits they receive, any problems that they came up with. So we do, it's really a three-prong approach then. One that focuses on process, one that focuses on when you're in the current program, and then finally when you leave, what's happened to you, why did you leave, were there problems that caused you to get out. We hope to do that over the next year with the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program also. We find that information has been very helpful to us with the high-risk pool in that it's allowed the board then to get information that manages the pool that really has helped them in terms of benefit design and paying attention to what it is we actually offer folks. So that's kind of what our goals have been that we've had it really established over this last year.
Okay. Any questions so far?
Yeah. I'd like to get into a little bit about the agency history. First of all, the IPGB was established in 1987 to offer health benefit plans to small businesses, and that was our primary mission. There was no staff at that point. It was just a citizen board. They had no funds. In 1989, they actually, working with the carriers, the insurance carriers in the state, offered health insurance plans to previously uninsured businesses. There was a tax credit with that. There was also an employer mandate that was attached in 1989, that if a certain number of people didn't enroll in these plans by October or July of 1993, then an employer mandate would kick in into the state of Oregon and become the law. In 1993, the legislature decided that enrollment was very low. We had, at that point, only two staff persons. We had maybe four, five, 6,000 folks enrolled. It was part of the agreement to phase basically the employer mandate out and replace it by providing funds to the IPGB to go out and actually market these plans to small businesses. When that took place, if you'll look at the graph on page 3, you'll see that once we got that marketing money, the enrollment in the plans absolutely took off until the high point of 1996, when over 33,000 small employer dependents and employees were enrolled in one of the IPGB certified plans. Let me give you a little background to that. Is that 1996 and 95 and 97, the legislature passed a lot of reforms based on federal law as well as some state initiatives that provided guaranteed issue and pretty good access to health benefit plans for all businesses, whether they were insured before or not insured before. Medical inflation was almost zero at that point. We call it the effect of both the managed care that had been coming out in the early 90s was starting to take hold and keep prices down. You also had what we call the Hillary effect, when the Clinton administration was looking at some national models. I think everybody was reacting to that by making sure that the health care costs were being kept in line, because they didn't want to give the federal government any excuse at that point or the administration to move forward to some national model. So things were going good in 96 and 97, and what you saw was a slow migration out of our programs into the regular market. Now, these aren't people that just became uninsured. It's they could get just as good a deal in the regular market as they could with an IPGB plan. And unusual for state government, in consultation with legislative leadership, the governor's office, the agent community, small businesses, and the carriers, we decided to phase out the program. That we felt that things were going good, inflation was low, access was good, so a decision was made by the 1999 legislature to phase out and close down the certified plan, and by the year 2000 that was accomplished. One could say that might have been a big mistake, because about the time we were deciding to close down, because things were working so well in the market, inflation started kicking in, managed care started to die, the number of insured businesses that offered dependent coverage, they started to drop dependent coverage, they started raising deductibles, so all heck broke loose in about 1999 through 2001, that started giving us the double-digit inflations where some of the small employers were facing 20% to 30% increases every year. So in the year 2003, the legislature directed the agency through House Bill 2537 to develop new plans for uninsured small businesses. Basically, get back in the business you were in, recognizing that it's a different world today than it was 1990, that costs are very different. I should tell you that in 1990, we offered a plan for $250 deductible or a $500 deductible for $53. And I assure you, you can't drive by a hospital today and look at it for the same price that you could get coverage in those days. So it is a different...
Just a moment, please. Mr. Rocky, yep. $53 what? Per year?
Month per employee.
Okay, per member per month.
Per member per month. And that goes back to 1990. Now, that was indexed to some inflation. So in 1999, that was about $68. But for $68, you could only get a $2,500 deductible if you had a healthy group. And so basically, the market had changed so much that, you know, to get an average $500 deductible plan at that point was going to cost you in $150 to $200 a month, whereas 10 years prior to that, it was in the $50 to $75 per month. Again, if you had a healthy group. One of the nice things actually about the IPGB plans initially was that they could health underwrite. That's also not good because those firms that had employees that had health conditions couldn't get health insurance. In 1996, with the reforms put in place by the 95 legislature, we provided guaranteed issue in the individual or in the group market. So irrespective of whether you had a health condition, an employee with a health condition, your business could buy health insurance beginning in 1996. And that was a key thing that drove some people out of the IPGB plans into the regular market, as well as starting to see some of the increases we saw because you started to get groups that had more unhealthy workers. So the 2003 legislature decided that it was time for us to get back in the business. We have. We designed basically two plans, an alternative group plan and a children's group plan for the children of the employees that I'll talk about a little bit later in more detail. And those were became effective on March 1st of this year, just about a week and a half ago. We have a lot of quotes out. We have a couple enrollments, but it's still early because they really couldn't start putting these people on board until March 1st. We've been out again to 30 cities or 30 sessions in 23 or 24 different cities over the last month to provide training to both agents as well as carrier representatives. The plans are only offered by two carriers, HealthNet and of Oregon and Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. All 16 small group carriers were offered the opportunity to join in and offer these plans, but those are the only two that step forward, knowing that it's kind of a high-risk market, and I always want to say publicly that the board has appreciated their commitment to trying to get some of these uninsured businesses and the Oregonians that work for them into the insured ranks. We're talking about small businesses here. You're going to be talking about what we call mom-and-pop stores, two, three, four, five employees. Those businesses, generally with more than 10 employees, are going to buy something that's more appropriate to the regular market as opposed to these plans where the alternative plan is somewhat light in benefits, and we can talk about that in more detail later. Information and education and outreach. This came from the 1993 legislative session where they provided us funding and some staff to really work with communities and agents and carriers and small businesses to provide as much information around their health insurance options as we can. We started the agent referral program in 1993. We have continuing education programs that we do for agents. We have this new agent training program. You know, every month, 100 or I don't know how many it is, but a large number of agents get licensed in this state. And they do that by taking CRAM courses and then going in and taking their tests and getting licensed and coming out. But they really don't have a good understanding. They have enough understanding to pass a test, but not a good understanding of all the public-private options that people have around health insurance. So we just started in this last year what we call new agent school. Anybody who just gets their license, we try to have a four-hour training session around public and private training program or health insurance programs to really ground them on the things that are available to their clients in this state. And we've just started those. We do them here in Salem, except for four times a year we go to Bend and to Medford and to Pendleton. So we try to do at least one in the outlying areas once a year also. We also have a number of publications that we can provide you. We work with the Small Business Center so that every month every business that registers in this state receives some information on health insurance options, and we send out, I don't know how many that is, I want to say 3,000 a month of those to people that inquire or register as a new business. It really, the education outreach program has been critical for the agent referral program. As you can see down here, these are individuals or small businesses on the chart on page 4 that make requests to us to be put in contact with an agent. And the 2004 figure is going up simply because we're doing some expansion on the FIAT program and trying to build it up, so we're having many more agent referral requests. On page 5, you'll note that the chart there shows the number of training sessions. Since 2002, when we were able to secure the federal funding and use that match with some of our state funding around training and outreach, we've been able to expand the number of training sessions that we do with health insurance agents throughout the state. And some of these training sessions can be in a little rural committee with four agents, or they can be in Portland with 200 agents. We really will go any place. It is not a size issue to us. That's kind of the background on the information, education, and outreach. Talk a little bit about Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, what is commonly called FIOP. It came out of the 1997 legislature when we were talking about and looking at expanding the public sector side of the Oregon Health Plan. There was real concern on the part of many legislators, as well as the governor, that we didn't leave behind a whole bunch of folks that were out there working who didn't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid program, or for a variety of reasons chose not to enroll into one of the other public programs under the Oregon Health Plan. And so they established a model called FIOP, with a limited budget to serve about 15,000 people, and that passed in 1997. We implemented in March of, July of 1998. Now, this is to kind of give you an idea of the rocky road, and I hate to use that word, that this this program has had. When we came out the door in July of 1998, it was under a budget that was directed, and the legislature directed us to serve 15,000 Oregonians. And over the next three or four months, we put on about 7,500 of those. And then all of a sudden, budget crunch, and it was cut back to 7,500. So that kind of started the come out the door, and then all of a sudden bring it back. And when we get into some of these other pages, you'll see how we started high and it just started to go down, because IPGB FIOP became basically the budget balancer to some degree for all the other aspects of the Oregon Health Plan. So we could have 15,000 coming out the door, then it was 7,500, then it was about 6,500, then it was 4,000, and we just slowly came down, which was difficult to manage because when you're trying to work with employers or individuals and say, come on board and join us, they were always worried that once they made that commitment, especially on the part of employers, that we would pull the funding and the employers would be left picking up the subsidies for those low-income employees. So it's really been a difficult time to finally get going, and we'll talk about this in a minute, but since July of this last year, July and August, we have for the first time been able to say there's no waiting list, we have openings, come on board, and you'll see the results of that kind of message back out to the employer as well as the individual community. I want to talk about in 2001, the legislature passed House Bill 2519 that directed FEOP to do two major things. One, move to a 50-50 split of resources between group and individual market. The real need out there is probably in the individual side, but from an economic side, it's a lot cheaper to put people in group. If group coverage is available, you'll see the costs is about half of what the individual market is because of the employer contributions. So the legislature said, we want you to go out and expand, but we want to make sure that 50% of our resources go into group and 50% go into the individual market. The second thing they said was, we want you to go seek through DHS and their waiver process, the ability to get federal funds, both Title 19 and the Medicaid, as well as Title 21 CHIP, or Children's Health Insurance Program funds, so we could really leverage the state dollars that we're putting in this program. The Emergency Board in 2002, between that time and the Emergency Board, I should tell you there were three committees. And some of the members of this committee here can probably help on this a little bit as well as I can. But there were three committees. First was what was called the waiver. What was it called? The waiver
advisory steering
application steering committee, made up of 20 to 25 representatives from the legislature, from business, from hospitals, from docs. They really came together, and Carrie Barnett was the chair of that at that point, was with ODS Health Systems, and they really kind of designed what the waiver should look like, gave it kind of the framework of what FEOP should do, what OHP in terms of Medicaid and standard population should do, what the major objectives and goals were. And that committee then provided a report to what was called the leadership group of the legislature, and that was made up of I want to say four or five key legislative leaders, including the Senate President and representatives from the House, who really kind of, I think, put the pieces together from a state policy perspective. The WASC, or the Waiver Application Steering Committee, involved the citizens as well as legislators, and then the leadership group really passed on the final recommendations for that group. Then it went to the Emergency Board. In 2002, the Emergency Board directed the Insurance Pool Governing Board to add up to 25,000 people into the FEOP program, which was later reduced at the end of that year to 14,000 because, again, of state budget constraints. The problem we had was when the Legislature Emergency Board told us to go get 25,000 folks in May of 2002, about 3 or 4 or 5 months later, we put all the infrastructure together to do that, and then all of a sudden we were cut back to 14,000 folks, left with more building space and more equipment than what we really needed. And that's what led to, and you'll see this when we get to the performance measures, to a blip in the administrative costs, because we were just saddled with that based on the planning we were doing. Included in that waiver request to the federal government was what is called the maintenance of effort requirement. And this is critical to the FEOP program from a policy perspective, a political perspective, and a funding perspective. And let me go through that a little bit with you. And I'll ask Becky if I say something wrong, tap me on the shoulder here. She knows this much better than I do. So part of the terms and conditions with the federal government to get the federal matching dollars, because FEOP had not existed before, they said you have to have what's called a maintenance of effort. And basically it says whatever you were spending in the base year in state general fund dollars prior to the waiver, you had to spend that average for at least 5 years going forward. We spent in our base year $8.175 million of state dollars. We had no federal funds available. So basically what they said was over the next 5 years, you have to spend $40.9 million of state general fund dollars. You didn't have to spend $8 million a year. You could spend $1 million for the first 4 years and $36 million the last year. And that was critical because as we were going through some of the budget problems that the state faced, again, FIAT became a budget balancer, and if you needed $2 million, you needed $3 million, we would go ahead and pull that out. So there was some conscious decisions on the part of the legislature to spend less than what was required in the maintenance effort with the idea at some point we can all catch up on this. Well, we've caught up. And that is one of the reasons you're seeing a state budget request go basically from the $12 to $13 million general funds up to a little over $20 million in general funds, simply because that then allows us to meet our maintenance of effort requirement. Now, a lot of people ask, what happens if you don't meet it? And there's a paper that gives you some pretty good legal background from our consultants as well as the Attorney General's office on this. The short answer is nobody knows because no state has ever not met the maintenance of effort requirement.
Mr. Britton. And Rocky, the paper that you're referencing is in the appendix.
That is correct.
Members can read that if they'd like.
And in fact, Mr. Chair, it is the yellow, because we thought it was important, I guess. It's the only one that's color-coded in the back, but in the appendix, it's called the MOE discussion paper. Gives you the historical context, what the requirement is, some of the issues around failure to meet it, what could happen or not happen. Because the Department of Human Services in the state of Oregon is getting very near entering into negotiations with the federal government, I think we're in about 6 months before we notify them, and then we have another year to negotiate a continuation of our current demonstration project. It was really felt that it was not the appropriate time to try to renegotiate the terms and conditions of the current waiver demonstration project. It would put you at a disadvantage for the negotiations that are going to take place in the next year. Secondly, is that no one can tell us really what there is to negotiate. Could they give you more time? Would they require you to pay the federal dollars back? So that I think the decision on the part of the governor, which was appropriate, was we meet the maintenance of effort. That was what we agreed to with the federal government, and we should keep that agreement so as to not to jeopardize any of our other programs that are supported through the Title 1921 funds.
Mr. Chair. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the 17,000 lives insured meet the maintenance of effort if you reach that goal this year?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, this year or the next biennium?
This next biennium.
If we get to the 21,000 is what we are projecting for the next biennium in terms of enrolled lives, that would meet the maintenance of effort.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Where are you? I mean, you've had to open up the individual market to do that. What kind of response are you getting in the individual market? Is it moving up as you expected now? Are you getting a good response? I know it's not the most economical way to do it. We get a better bang for our buck in the group market, but since it's not moving, where are you in the individual market?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, and I'll ask John if you want to pass that back. If you turn the page, I've got kind of four charts that can show you what's happened, and I think will answer your question. On page six, now let me retrack a little bit, if I can, Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, and help you understand what we did and the decision that was made in July. We had two things that were keeping our enrollment down. One was the 50-50 split in group, and we got permission from the last legislature to make that a goal but not constrict us to opening up the individual market. The second, though, was ballot measure 30. When ballot measure 30 was put forth, The governor and members of the legislature were very concerned about what the impact that would have on the total Oregon health plan. And until decisions were made coming out of ballot measure 30 passage, they wanted us not basically to market the program, to keep it down just in case the legislature or the governor reached agreement on utilizing some of the funds that were in the FEOP program. Finally, in July of this year, we got the authority to open up the market, to start marketing it, go out to all the communities, tell the folks about it, and enroll them. And you'll see in the first chart on page 6, you'll see what's happened in terms of applications since we started marketing that program. That's the monthly number of applications. The second thing you'll chart on page 6 you'll see is just the number of telephone calls that have increased. Part of that is because of the standard population closing. We're starting to get a lot of calls from there. The third chart, and I'll refer to you really with the peak sheet here, shows you over the biennium how when we started in July, we had about 5,500 individuals enrolled, and how that has just started to take off and is now sitting at about 9,400 people enrolled. We have another 3,000 that have been approved to be enrolled, and we have another 3,800 lives that we've received that we're currently enrolling. Doing application review to see if they are eligible for the program or not. The other thing you should point out on the chart is you can see the group enrollment and how it has changed as well as the individual. So just opening up this program in July of this year in terms of going out and marketing and telling people there is no waiting list and giving some assurances that it's in the governor's budget, you can see that the activity over the last 2 or 3 months has been pretty dramatic. What we're more encouraged by is not the enrolled lives. That's great, 9,400, but it's the number of approved lives that we have out there that are out there looking for insurance now. Ms. Chair, Senator Bates, does that kind of answer your question on that particular piece?
It does, Mr. Chair. A couple of follow-up questions, though.
Senator Bates.
First, it's reassuring the numbers are going up. I'm hoping that what you're saying is going to mean our maintenance of effort in this, because I don't want to be in a situation that CMS says to us, prior to us talking to them, you have not met your maintenance of effort, we're pulling this waiver and jeopardizing the waiver for OHP 2. It could be a bigger waiver issue than just the FEOP program. Having said that, as our standard population is being decreased on a basis basically of who comes in and who goes out first, has there been any effort to contact those individuals as they come out of the standard population and offer them the FEOP program on an individual basis? You seem to mention that you may be picking up some of the standard population. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, Ms. Chair, Senator Bates, about 36% of the population enrolled in FEOP have incomes below 100% of poverty level. Now, how many of those would have been eligible for standard versus children? I don't have that information in front of me, but we do pick up a large number and have been picking up a large number of individuals that have such much drop standard. We always get those that are determined and eligible for standard because their income's too high. But it's those people who call OHP and...
Excuse me?
Yep.
We have a flyer that goes into the denial letters that OHP sends out.
That's correct. There's two groups. One, those people who lose eligibility, they obviously can come to us. Their incomes are too high. Now they have those that apply, and because they're closed, they're turned down, and a flyer is put in each one of those denials to OHP, letting them know about the existence of FEOP. Very similar to what we do when somebody applies to us, we accept or reject them, but we also, in our letters to them, even those that are accepted, let them know what their options are on the OHP Medicaid side. So they are, I think, informed.
Mr. Chair?
Oh.
Thank you for doing that. I appreciate it. One of the concerns I have with the standard program is that we are causing it to decrease because we need to match our budgetary situation. But it's being decreased on the basis of people dropping out of the program and for not being able to pay the premium or whatever reason. And we're going to end up with a situation where we're going to have people inside the program who have managed to stay there at a higher income level than people outside the program. This might be a way of answering that problem, is what I'm concerned about. So if they, so if people apply for OHP standard, and while people inside the program might be at a higher income level, they should qualify for this program. And the subsidy is substantial. I think most of your premiums for these people would probably be about $25-$30 a month, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Well, Chair Senator Bates, the average premiums, and I believe that's going to be on page 9 for individual market, is about $20 per member. For the high risk pool, about $30 per member. The primary difference, just two things, and like we've talked about before, you've got people that would that are in standard now that pretty much don't have a lot of copays and deductibles of any kind of size. Their out-of-pocket costs are pretty minimal. You come to the commercial market, that's not the case. Everybody in Fiat, for example, in the individual market, is going to generally have a $500 deductible plan simply because you can't get anything better than that unless you go to an HMO like Kaiser, and we have a good Kaiser presence. But so there's a lot more out-of-pocket for the private sector side than the standard population. The other piece to that, and I think this gets to the chair's issues around sometimes using the FPL level, there are many people that are at 10 and 15, 20, 30% of the federal poverty level who have resources available to them outside of their own income, whether that's family, community, have more resources in some cases than somebody at 100% of the federal poverty level. So sometimes just using the federal poverty level is a little misleading because of other resources that may be available to the individual. The other piece that we find with the Fiat program and with OHP standard is there are some folks that are earning 100% of the federal poverty level who cannot navigate a private health care system. They don't have whatever mental health issues they have, or just where they are in terms of understanding. It's tough for them to figure out how to get an application, how to use that Blue Cross or ODS or Health Net card. But somebody at 20% may be just somebody that's down on their luck, working part-time or whatever it may be, who can navigate that system. So while I agree with you that I think we need to look at how to meld these two with what's going on with standard, I think sometimes we've got to sit back and say it may not be as simple as what first meets the eye. This is my thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope I'm connecting the dots right, so correct me where I'm missing here. There's somewhere around $6 million that's unspent for the current biennium. Is that correct? That we haven't used up in the Fiat money? And we've got 9,400 lives now. What would we have to get to use up all that money? And I guess my question then becomes, then you add another almost $12 million in general fund to that. You know, are we putting so much money in there that we don't have a realistic target? Can we get that many people physically enrolled in the program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I think that's a good question. We think we're going to get between up to 14,000 to 15,000 was our objective by July. And if we enroll the 1,000 a month that we think we have the administrative capacity to do, we'll reach that objective and expend our general fund dollars that are appropriated this biennium. So it won't put us in a position next biennium of having to be hopefully too far behind. The next biennium, if we start in the 14 to 15,000 enrollment, it will allow us to go to the 21,000, and we have about a 12-month period to get there. So we're going up like this now, and at some point we have to start leveling that off, and we think that'll hopefully start leveling off in far after the July period, so we reach that 21,000. I don't know if that answers.
Well, thank you. Follow up. Would it spend the additional unspent money? I mean, would you be able to get through all of that if you do ramp up to, you know, if you get up to the 12.5 number by the end of the biennium?
Chair, Representative Hanna, yes. The plan that we have is to expend those dollars and meet the maintenance of effort. And the enrollment figures that we have would get us to that level.
Would you mind going in just a little bit more detail on, you know, using average premiums? I'm looking on page 9.
Oops, skipping ahead. Okay.
And if 49% of the people that are on the plan
are at 95% subsidy. What is, do you have a breakdown? What does that mean for those folks? If you're getting 95% subsidy, how much are they paying?
Well, okay, Mr. Chair, let me, and that's page 8 and 9, which gives you kind of a breakdown of the enrollment. And I think, Mr. Chair, you're talking about the bottom of page 9 where we talk about average premiums. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Let me talk about the three markets, first of all, so everybody understands the three markets that we operate in. First of all, it's an individual market. In this state, if you are healthy and don't have some pre-existing health conditions and you're not offered group coverage, you go to what's called the individual market. There are a number of carriers. We certify 6 major domestic carriers that our people have the choice to go to. If you're healthy, you get in. And that's the first line, what we call individual non-OMIP. But this state does allow for underwriting in the individual market. That is, if you have a pre-existing health condition, cancer, MS, high blood pressure, just about name any health, major health condition, then you're going to be denied that coverage. Those people go to the high-risk pool. And they're surcharged, and I'll talk about that a little bit in a few minutes. Then the third group that we serve are those people that are eligible for group coverage. If someone has group coverage available to them and it meets a benchmark that's been established by us in terms of the benefits, then they must enroll them in the group market, themselves in the group market. We can also split off families if somebody wants the group market and they don't provide dependent coverage. We can also provide individual markets. So those three markets have kind of different dynamics and different populations they serve. Let's talk about the individual market first of all. The question, Mr. Chair, I think was, if you are at the 95% level, what kind of premium would you pay? Our average premium is $198, and 5% of that, or approximately $10, is going to be your payment if you are at the 95% level. You're going to have with that a $500 deductible plan at the minimum. And secondly, I think that's really important, is that the number of kids involved in this is 31%. The individual plan has 31% children enrollment and 69% adult enrollment. On pages 25, 26, and 27 of the agency brief, and I don't know if you want to go into that detail, you go back into the appendix, and I believe the agency brief would be the third material in, third group of materials in, on the you'll see on starting on page, actually it's page 25, it gives you the average subsidy levels for the different enrollment types, group, individual, as well as OMIP, those with portability, those who have COBRA available, and it breaks it down by the subsidy levels. If you're on page 25, if you'll look at the top or the middle where it says average subsidy for group market, you'll see the premium share for somebody at 95% of the subsidy is $124. The subsidy per month is $118. Member contribution for the group market is $624, and that's $95 is the employer contribution. If you turn the page, page 26, you'll see the individual market. This is on the agency brief.
We're trying to find the...
In the appendix.
In the appendix.
We're looking at the graph. That's a couple of green sheets later.
It would be the second green sheet going in. If you had the green dividers, it's right up front. You go to page 26, I think, gets to, Mr. Chair, your question very specifically.
Okay. Does second come after first?
Usually.
Not in the state budgeting system, Senator Westland.
Depends if your appendix has been taken.
Yeah, we're just trying to clarify.
So we have everybody on page 26 of the agency brief. And if you'll look at the top of that, the non-OMIP individual market, and you'll see in the, gives you the different number of people within the subsidy. And the second one is the second chart is the average subsidy for the non-OMIP individual market. Taking the 95% premium or subsidy level, the premium average is 202. Subsidy per month is $192.78. The member contribution is $10.15. I want to point out that unlike OHP with their CHIP program serving children, children in our program are assessed premiums. So a family has to pay premiums not only for the adults but for children. In OHP, Medicaid, CHIP, children do not have premiums.
So you're not collecting that from the kids, though. It's not the lunch money, right?
We hold up. I'll leave that alone.
Rocky, would it be helpful if I handed this out
sure.
at this point?
To get an idea of the poverty levels, there's a yellow sheet that we've put together. These are the new federal poverty levels effective, I believe, February 18th.
When it says member contribution, is that per person then for the family?
That's per person. The member contribution would be per person enrolled. So if you were, for example, a mother with two kids, you'd be paying $30.45 if all three were, you were at the 95% subsidy level and you were in the individual market.
And the subsidy is based on individual income, not family income?
Mr. Chair, it's based on the family income. And that would be this chart here. So if you are at 95% of the subsidy level, for example, and say you had a family of three, that would be up to $1,676 per month. That's before taxes. And you would be responsible for $30 in premiums plus all copays and deductibles. And most of the maximum out-of-pockets on most of the individual plans are generally $5,000. So this is the upfront premium dollar is relatively modest compared to this. It's the exposure that some of these folks take for the rest of the health care, the copays and the deductibles, that is really their contribution, major contribution, different than OHP Medicaid, where there won't be those other cost factors. Did that get to what you needed? Okay, now I need to find where I was here. Going back to the front again on page 8 and 9. I think that on page 9, the two little charts above that on page 9 are kind of interesting. They give you an average cost breakdown and who pays what in the individual and group markets. And best way to say this is in the individual market, the average member is going to pay 9% of the premium. General funds, state funds, pay about 30%. Other funds, meaning the federal funds, pay 61%. When you come down to the group market, and why it's such a good deal, I think, as Senator Bates mentioned earlier, is that the employer is picking up 44% of the cost, the employee about 8, the FEOP subsidy about 48, of which then 15 is general fund dollars, and 33% of that are the state, or excuse me, the federal funds that we receive. So the group market is significantly less expensive than the individual market, again, because of the employer contribution, and partly because of the way family coverage is priced in the group market. You do a family rate as opposed to the individual market, where rates are generally based on ages of everybody enrolled.
Okay. Representative Hanna.
Rocky, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are there instances where very small employers, say 5 and under, where the employer could participate much like you're showing in the group plan here, but have individuals signed up, or are any small employers, any number of employees, 2, 3, are they all a group?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, every business, irrespective of size, can have employees or dependents signed up. I should tell you that most employers pay for the premiums of their employees, small or large. So most of the subsidy that we do in the employer group market is for dependent coverage, or for people who are working less than full time. There are people that work half time where they have to pay the full premium in order to get the health care benefit, but the employer may prorate based on number of hours, like the state of Oregon does. We prorate. If somebody only works half time, we only give 50% contribution towards their health insurance. In those instances, we will subsidize those people, but it's any size business. It's not limited to whether it's a group of two or three.
May I follow up? Okay, I want to understand. Let's say you have an employer who offers no insurance, but you have a mother of three who works there, makes $10 an hour, and they come to the employer and say, hey, I know of this FEOP program. Will you participate with me? And the employer says, well, yeah, I'd like to, but I don't have a group health insurance program. Could they, on an individual basis, participate?
Yes, Ms. Chair, Reps. Hannah, they then, if they don't have a group option, they then can come to the individual market. Is that what you mean?
Yes, and can the employer contribute?
No, the employer, by state law, can't contribute towards the purchase of individual coverage. And the reason for that is they did not want employers farming out the bad risks to the individual market. So if you provide health care benefits, you have to provide it to not just the whole group.
He could deduct it. Yeah. He could give her a raise in pay.
Right. But I was trying to determine how this worked. I haven't seen it, so I'm trying to see how it came together. That answers my question.
Okay, I will turn the page, unless you have more questions there, to talk about some of the agency's successes briefly, and then we'll get into, I think, some key organizational issues. We've served over 22,000 people since 1997 in FEOP, and I'm on page 10. Our regional geographic representation in the FEOP program is equivalent to each region's percentage of the state's uninsured population, and our statistical package back there, it's very interesting to look at some of the outlying rural counties, and we are very our enrollments are very high, for example, in Southern Oregon compared to the population. The one county where we don't have I think as many people as the state uninsurance rate or the percentage of population is in the Multnomah County area, and that's primarily because the incomes are higher. So you're going to find probably less of those people that would be eligible for this. But we've done a pretty good job. There are some coastal communities that we still want to work on that we don't think we've done enough penetration there. But when you start getting out to the Bend and the Gold Beaches and the southern coast, we've done a real good job there.
Question, how often is there an evaluation of qualification for people that are in a group plan as far as the subsidy is concerned?
Mr. Chair, good question. And on the back of the pink form, let me take a minute and just run through the eligibility and what we do. FEOP eligibility. First of all, you have to have a average monthly income of not more than 185% of federal poverty level. We look back 3 months. They must reside in Oregon. They must be a U.S. citizen or a qualified non-citizen. Must have been without health insurance for the previous 6 months, except for those people coming off of OHP Medicaid. So we allow people to transition off of Medicaid or OHP CHIP program into our program. Must have investments and savings less than $10,000. All eligible children in a family must have health insurance before adults can use the subsidy. People that are eligible for Medicare are not eligible for the subsidy. And the eligibility period is 12 months. So every 12 months, we determine eligibility. And when we established this with the legislature back in 1997, and we kind of laid this out, there are a couple things that are different than OHP. The first is assets. And the board, in working with the advocates and some of the legislative leadership, said, let's make sure that we're allowing people to save money, not just expend all their money. And so they established an asset level that was about $5,000 higher than what general OHP Medicaid is. The second is they wanted people to have a chance and most of these folks are working Oregonians. We do have some disabled folks that earn too much money to qualify for Medicaid and who have not yet qualified for Medicare. But generally, you're talking about working Oregonians. And we wanted to make sure that health insurance was in the background, not in front of them all the time. So we made an explicit decision to provide 12 months of eligibility. Goes back to a question somebody said, well, what happens if somebody's income goes up during those 12 months? And our response is, that's what we want. We want our people to earn more money. We want our people to come up at redetermination and have earned too much money to qualify. What happens if people earn less? That's kind of the gamble you take when you get into the program because we don't adjust subsidy levels during the year.
Okay, a question on investments. Does that include equity in home?
Pardon?
The investments and savings, are those liquid or including equity and real estate?
Chair, the home, auto, tools of the trade, a qualified retirement account, one that basically you'd have to incur a penalty if you came back, those are excluded from that. We also, a couple things, we ask for tax returns. That's something that very few states, as well as other programs in our state, don't do because we found that in our early auditing, random auditing that we did, that there were folks that had other incomes or other assets that you didn't necessarily catch on a voluntary basis. So we think we do a pretty good job of checking between the Employment Department wage records, between DMV in terms of some of the residential issues, and the tax returns. We think we do a pretty good job of keeping the fewest number of people out of the program that really don't deserve to get in.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes-Anderson.
What if you have an individual that was employed but eligible for FEOP and then lost their job? What happens to
them? Mr. Chair, Senator Montes-Anderson, they have a number of options. First of all, we pay COBRA or portability. So if they lose their group coverage and they don't move to another employer with group coverage, we will subsidize either portability, state continuation, or COBRA coverage. They also can choose to apply on an individual basis to the individual market, and we will continue them. So loss of coverage is not a loss of subsidy. And that's a really good point because we found in some recent audits, and they're not audits, but they're just case reviews where we try to figure out what happens to people, that a number of people dropped out of the group market who didn't understand that they had the COBRA and portability options available to them. And so we're trying to even beef that piece up. Even though we say it in all our brochures, we're going to try to pay better attention to that in the group market because it is an issue because these people do change jobs.
Yep.
These are lower income. These folks don't work for an employer for 25 years.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I hope that did that answer your questions on the residency side. Okay, we get into the agency organization. Go through this briefly. The IPGB, Insurance Pool Governing Board, was established again in 1987 as a state agency, first funded and staffed in 1990. At the same time, the legislature established the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the state's high-risk pool, and both of those were separate state agencies. One had money and one had positions. So the boards got together and talked about this and said, how can we combine, because we're relatively small, our resources of physician authority and the money to basically operate this program? And they reached an interagency agreement in 1990 that basically shares administrative staff between the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool and the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And that agreement has stood for 15 years. Now, OMIP became a part of DCBS in 1993. Despite that, that agreement has continued. So we have eight staff on the OMIP side that continue. Four of those provide some administrative support, including myself, the fiscal manager, the business manager, another fiscal support person that provides support to both programs. OMIP is not a part of IPGB, and I want to make sure that that's understood. It really is a part of DCBS. Corey Streisinger is the director of DCBS and oversees the appointment of the board that manages that. In 1993, even though OMIP moved to DCBS, the IPGB board, through a decision made by the legislature, it was decided to stand on its own and remain as a separate state agency. And the areas that we are involved in then as a group, and we share again a lot of the same common customers, from customer service to administration and fiscal, health care policy coordination, information, education, outreach, the small health insurance plans for our small employer health insurance plans, and then FEOP. And on page 12, we kind of outline the different areas and what comes under each one of those areas as to what we do. The OMIP we put in here because we're all kind of combined, but it's kind of in a lighter gray to remind us all that really it is a separate state agency under, or state program under, the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We are managed by a board that's made up of seven individuals appointed by the governor. Our chair is Steve Doty, who represents insurance agents. We have consumers, as well as labor and employer representatives. We have two positions that are vacant, and they are being held vacant pending Senate Bill 303, which restructures the insurance pool governing board and makes the board become advisory as opposed to policymaking. And that will have a subsequent referral, I believe, to Ways and Means after it is heard in its substantive committee, which I think Senator Mo Sanderson is your committee.
Okay, would you explain why that's taking place?
Sure. Mr. Chair, in 1987, when they put the board together, and it was a policymaking board to do the certified plans, there was no budget. And in 1990, the budget was $250,000. In 1997, the budget had grown to $500,000. And for a consumer or public sector board or a volunteer board, that was still a manageable amount of dollars, $500,000. When the legislation was passed in 97 to implement FEOP, to add that, that brought millions of dollars into the coffers here for the agency to manage. And the legislation kind of took the board out of the decision-making role as it related to FEOP, because of its size in terms of dollars and the necessity to really coordinate with the larger context of the Oregon Health Plan, what DHS was doing, what the governor's office was doing. So their role was somewhat diminished on that part. We're at an $80 million in the governor's budget request. And to have just a seven-member public board manage that, I think the governor felt the accountability was better to have that as an advisory committee. And to the board, we'd have to change the name because it wouldn't be a board anymore, but to put them in an advisory role so that there was better accountability from the governor's office down to the agency. They couldn't just go off on a direction that was different than what the waivers or the policies were of the legislature or around some of the health care programs.
So how will the graph look for organizational chart?
Well, the graph chart, Mr. Chair, is if you turn to page... I guess it's page 14. It gives you kind of a look at the 50 FEOP positions, the two information, education, and outreach positions, and the eight OMIP positions. That kind of shows you where OMIP kind of fits into this.
I guess what I'm asking is if
the OMIP administrator would report directly to the governor as any agency head does.
Okay. Then why would it not make sense that OMIP become part of DHS?
You mean IPGB?
No, I'm talking about, well, let's see.
OMIP is a part of DCBS.
It's not part of IPGB. It is separate, and it's part of DCBS. And so if it's part of DCBS, but it's really duplicating in a lot of ways the work that's done in DHS, I'm not sure why it should remain under the Department of Consumer and Business Services when it's really a health issue and a health insurance plan like we have presently under DHS.
Well, Ms. Chair, if I may take a few minutes to talk about this, because it really goes back to a lot of discussions that have taken place, and I've been here since 1990 and been generally a part of those. It goes to some of the decisions made 10 years ago, 1993.
Okay, but like you said, it's grown so much that now an advisory board no longer would have the capability to deal with this kind of money.
Understand.
So,
understand.
I guess I'm saying cut to the chase and not the 10 years ago.
The Insurance Pool Governing Board is seen as a bridge between the public and private sectors.
Okay.
And to be, for example, at DHS, we would lose a great deal of credibility, a great deal of relationship with what is considered to be the private sector, the carriers, the agents, and the small employers. On the other hand, we're not really a regulatory program, so at DCBS, putting this in DCBS, we would lose a lot of the connection that we're seeing from the advocates in terms of the social side of the people that we serve. IPGB has been left out there in the middle between the DCBS side and the DHS side as its own agency, simply because it does what it does, which is to bridge those. Putting them at one place or the other didn't make any sense, because we would lose one of the constituencies that we work with. We have great credibility on both sides of the fence. We can sit down and talk with an insurance carrier about OHP and the CHIP program, and we can sit down and talk to them about adverse selection in small employer market. Putting them over one way or the other, you're going to lose that view that people have, which is right in the middle and the bridge. And it's been talked about every session. And an example of that was in 93, there was legislation for the Insurance Pool Governing Board, knowing that it's now a lot bigger, but to go under DHS.
Just a minute. Senator Wesson.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, kind of along the lines of what Mr. King is saying, I think it's very important not to lose sight of the cultures of the two ends of those organizations. And there's a different decision-making culture in the Commission and DHS. And to have the middle jammed into one side or the other, I think, would give a great deal of concern to one side or the other. And the word that Rocky uses with regard to bridge, I think, is appropriate. But I think a greater emphasis should be placed on the credibility of the decision-making, because the decision-making comes from a more neutral culture. And I'm not articulating this very well, but I think it's a very appropriate placement, and it's one of the things we've done in setting up the overall structure that has really benefited both the private side, the department side, but most importantly, the citizens over many years now.
I understand that, and I'm not proposing anything. I'm just asking the question, because I see that there's certainly some duplication of, or at least overlap in concerns. And I also see that as this expands, it's actually kind of a experiment that's not too dissimilar, or at least I see some similarities with what is being attempted in the experiment in Florida, where you're talking about providing medical coverage through private insurance companies, and that's what's happening here. And when you're talking about $10 a month cost, the standard population is in a similar situation to what this is, except the standard population is using state health plan funds to pay benefits, and this is using private insurance companies to pay benefits. But to the individual that's making the payment of the $10, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, although the benefits are certainly different. But anyway, so what I'm seeing is a kind of a separate track between what's happening with the Oregon health plan, the standard population, and FIOP, and so, which I think is healthy. I think it's healthy to see this, because the goal is to help assure that Oregonians have health coverage, and not all of them can afford it. And so, and certainly we don't want people to have to assure that they qualify by not being employed so they can get good benefits. I mean, this is actually promoting, because it is means tested, the thing that we're trying to do, and that is break the ceilings that say if you go through this, you lose your benefits, and on the contrary, say that as you do better, you can have benefits, and you'll just contribute more as you go along. I think that's very healthy. So anyway, I'm just kind of articulating some thoughts as I see what's taking place, and so I'm sure I understand it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Just to follow on your comments a bit, the Oregon Governing Board has formed a relationship that's very unique. It's a relationship of trust between the commercial carriers, Blue Cross Blue Shield and Kaiser and the rest, and they've come to trust this board to make rational, clear, and reasonable decisions concerning the uninsured who have previous existing conditions, and that is transferred over into the FEOP program. And quite frankly, considering state government, that is no small thing. And that's why this has been a successful group and why it has been expanded. It's one of those things we can point to that says, if we really want public-private partnerships that work, these are the kind of programs we have to continue. Mm-hmm. One of the strange things and good things that I've seen happen in your program, you're not only as we've been able to insure people who have pre-existing conditions so that that cost is shared by all the insurers in the state in a fair, equitable way. Nobody's getting hurt more than the other person. And when that started out 15 years ago, there were real questions about whether that was going to work or not. And Rocky's group has made that work. That's a real plus for us. But another thing that's happening in this group is we're seeing people who could qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, could qualify for Oregon Standard, who say, I'm going to stay in commercial insurance. I want to be a contributor to my health care. I'm willing to pay my $500 deductible. I'm willing to pay my copay. I'm willing to take on that personal responsibility, help hold down not only health care costs from the point of view of I'm paying my share of it, even though the premium is only $10. But also, it makes them think twice about going to the doctor and going to the emergency room and doing all the things that turn you on a complete benefit program where you have no personal cost to that might go the other direction. And trust me,
I understand.
I see a huge difference between this population in my office when they're on a FEOP program and when they're on OHP.
What a mistake.
The utilization difference is huge. And so trying to explain that strange relationship, Rocky, that you've tried to hear today, when I first heard about it, I was like, 10 years ago, I mean, if that really worked, and of course I've seen it work now, is a difficult one to do. And so I appreciate your questions because they're very germane in your answers, and I'm just trying to flesh those out so they make some sense here.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, that relationship, that trust, has allowed the commercial carriers to voluntarily continue to accept the commercial assessment to the individual private insurance companies to help fund the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And that wouldn't even be close to occurring if we didn't have this special, he calls it bridge, I call it culture of trust relationship that's been established over the years. It's very unique, and it's uniquely wonderful.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Because of limitations on time, I would like to make sure that we get some specific questions answered. One is, would you just skip over to the high-risk pool and explain the relationship of the state and how the high-risk pool really functions? I mean, we know how the individual markets function.
Okay.
I'd like to know about high-risk pool.
Mr. Chair, remember the high-risk pool was actually before you as a part of the DCBS budget. That's a separate budget issue, or that's a separate agency. But I'll go through that. But
I would appreciate it.
Gotcha.
I understand the group portion. I understand the individual market. Okay. I'm not clear.
What happens with the high-risk pool? If someone is turned down for health insurance coverage in this state, they have an option of going to the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which will provide guaranteed issue, irrespective of medical conditions, into that pool. Now,
it's like 125% of the average premium for individual policies.
Mr. Chair, the premiums established by that pool, they come out to, by statute, can be up to 125%. I want to say they're at
111?
I want to say the board has established them at about 111%, even though they can go higher. So the person pays the full premium, and any losses that are incurred by the pool then are assessed to health insurers that are licensed to do business in the state on the basis of the number of people they have insured. Now, if someone cannot afford the OMIP premium, and the premiums are pretty high because you're generally talking about 45-year-olds, 60% are female, the average age for OMIP in total is a little over 50, but for the fiat population it's about 45. So for those people who can't afford it, who've been uninsured for a period of 6 months, they do have the option of applying for a subsidy through fiat, which will help them pay their portion of the premiums to get into the high-risk pool. The high-risk pool has about 10,900 enrollments, which is the highest level that it's ever been. Part of the reason for that is that we've put a number of people into OMIP that could not afford to in the previous years and who now have the FEOP subsidy available to them. And again, those are generally older women who are still in the workforce but just don't have group coverage available to them.
How much money is in that pool?
Our projected budget for next biennium is, I believe, about $237 million.
67?
I think it's going to be about
$180 million for the next biennium for the high-risk pool. And about 60 to 65% of that is paid for through premiums that are paid for by the those enrolled, and the remaining 30 to 35% is paid for through the assessment of the insurance carriers.
Okay, when you say next biennium, are you talking about that's where you think the pool level will be, or that's the income to the plan in the next biennium?
No, that's where we think that the pool in terms of population and then the expenditures for the, in that pool will be for the next biennium.
Okay, so this is not just an escrow account that's the trust fund that's growing somewhere. It's you're paying as we go.
No, Mr. Chair, it is pay as you go. We collect the premiums just like an insurance company on a monthly basis. We project what our losses are going to be for the next 6 months. 6 months out, we do an assessment, and that assessment is done by the board, made up of representatives of carriers, providers. Carriers are dominant. They have 5 of the 9 positions. I appreciate Senator Westland's comments because they really have stepped forward. But they basically make the assessment on themselves and the other carriers for a six-month period. So at the end of 6 months or just before that, we add it up and say, do we need to assess for the next 6 months? And so every 6 months we assess based on the projected losses. The only funds that we have that we keep, reserve funds, if you may, we keep 1 month's claims plus $2 million so that if they're wrong on their assessment, then, and that's not very much, I'll tell you right now, you could not get a license as a health insurer doing that. But if they're wrong on their assessments, then we have funds there, because we've always said to the insurers, and they've always requested from us, we don't like assessments, but if we're going to have them, make them as predictable as you can. Don't come to us for special assessments. So we keep a small reserve that really has kept us from making any special assessments.
Okay, my final question on this is, how is this compared to what's done in other states? Is this unique to Oregon, or is this common among many states?
No, Mr. Chair, there are 31 states that have high-risk pools. And of those, there are probably, in my mind, 5 or 6 that are very successful, and Oregon is one of those. And what I mean by successful, a couple things. First of all, population, as a percentage of population enrolled. You know, you go down to California, who has a 20-25% uninsurance rate, 30 million people, and they have 10,000 people in their pool. In Oregon, we've got 11,000, and we've got 3 million. You go to Texas with 20-some-odd million people in their state, and they've got 25,000 in their pool. We got 3 million. So, first of all, I think we're successful because of the percentage of population.
Or secondly, we're sick.
Pardon?
Or we're really sick.
Mr. Chair,
your assumption is that having more people in this pool is a good thing, and I'm not sure, but we don't want to go there.
Mr. Chair, I will tell you that nationally they assume that 3%, I think it is, of the population that you have in your state uninsured, the number of uninsured, about 3% of that is supposed to be basically uninsured because of health conditions, and that's a national figure. That means that in Oregon we probably have 18 to 19,000 people of the 609,000 uninsured that are uninsured because of a pre-existing health condition. Our penetration in that is 11,000. We think that's pretty good compared to other states. Our costs are pretty good, too. First of all, we have lower health care costs in Oregon than generally, although we're catching up. But our loss ratios run around 150 to 160%. There are some states, their loss ratios, that is for every dollar in premium, how much they lose, run almost 200%. Our Our premiums are kept by our board, and again, I thank the carrier community for stepping up on this because they really are, I think, have some social commitment here. But our premiums are lower than most of the other 31 states. So how are we doing compared to other states? I think pretty well in almost all counts.
All right, thank you. That gives me the information I need. Please continue now.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm going to have you skip to page 16 because when we talk about the FIAT program, when we designed it in 1997, one of the things that we did was come before you and say, here are our principles that we want this program to operate off of, and we want to share those again with you. Some of you are new to the program. But it really frames what all the decisions we make are. First of all, we want to foster independence and self-reliance. The subsidy, I think, Mr. Chair, you said it, as we go up on the income ladder, the subsidy goes down and the people have to assume a greater responsibility. Encourages consumer shopping and consumer choice because we want people to have choice, and we do that by providing different options in the individual market. We just don't say, this is what you get, and this is the only thing you can get. And I'm reminded of when we first started, a man in a family in Medford who signed up for a $1,000 deductible plan. And we called him up on the phone and we said, you know, for five extra bucks a month, you can get a $500 deductible plan. Why do you want $1,000? And he was a rancher and tough times, and he said, you know, he says, I'm not looking for a handout. He says, I just want something to happen if, you know, I have a heart attack. I'll handle the day-to-day stuff. So we really, giving people those choices, it's interesting. People very often choose things that you would not imagine them choosing, that they really do have some dignity and want to take care of themselves. Respects confidentiality and maintains personal dignity. When you walk into a doctor's office, they look at you as a Blue Cross, a ODS, a Kaiser, just like everybody else. You don't have a little page that says you're on public assistance. So there's really some things that people feel pretty good about when they get the eligibility. The assures administrative simplicity and efficiency. I'm not there yet. And I will get there, but I'm not there yet. I will try to make this group process work easier. The individual market works pretty good, but the group is tough. It's not an entitlement. One of the things you said early was, we're going to give you some dollars, manage it within those dollars. You run out of those dollars, don't come back to us. And we've done that, I think, consistently. It is not an entitlement. Not every Oregonian is eligible in the sense that we only have enough funds to serve, and the governor's budget requests $21,000. Real-life issues, maintaining household budget. When we established the subsidy levels, we had to take into account what people's out-of-pocket costs in addition to the premiums were. Builds on strengths of the current system. Again, you know, when you look at people in the state, 2 million people get their health care benefits in the private sector, and through private sector employment or individual coverage. We wanted to build on that. The uninsured, the six-month period of uninsurance ensures we extend the health care coverage to those folks. We emphasize children. 33% of our enrollment is in children. In the group market, it's 47% of the enrollments in children. And finally, promotes equity in health care financing. These are folks that are working, paying taxes. I mean, we see their tax returns when they send them in. And not everybody pays taxes. The lower income folks don't. But those people that don't own homes and aren't able to write things off, and very few of these people own their own homes, I will tell you right now. These are all generally renters. But they're paying taxes that support those people on Medicaid, Medicare. They support the business deductions for health care insurance, but yet themselves can't afford it. And so that was really part of the principle on that. With time pressing, Ms. Chair, what I'd like to do is get into the performance measure and benchmarks, talk a little bit about that, and then the priorities. These are our performance measures. They're always, as we all know, a work in progress. First one is number of referrals made through an agent referral program. We believe that we will continue to hold at that level as we expand up to the 21,000. You'll see in 2005 goal, we're significantly higher than 206 and 207. It's because we think we'll start leveling out at that point. Number of training sessions or presentations. You know, we talked about this in our own internal staff. Why we established the goal of 25 a long time ago, we're not sure, because we did 25 this last month. We think we'll exceed that going out for the next 3 years. The number of insurance agents trained, the 1,000 goal that we have through 205-207 is a historical goal. We exceeded it this year because of the certified health insurance plans that will be coming out, and because of the decision to expand FEOP, if the legislature appropriates the funds, to 21,000. The average or annual number of Oregonians enrolled in FEOP, these figures will have to be adjusted based on the governor's budget request and submitted to the progress report, because they still have us at the 15,000 limit, and that's actual people served within a year. The increase in percentage of approved FEOP applications who enrolled in health insurance coverage. Spend an hour on this issue, but I won't. But you get a application, you approve it, you send it out. Only about 50% of the people end up actually getting health insurance. Now, some of those go to OHP because we tell them there are other options. Hey, you got kids, you may want to put them in CHIP program, or you may be, if you're disabled, you may want to look for at OHP. So there's a variety of different options that they can make. Some just obtain group coverage.
Okay. Mr. Britton.
Rocky,
yep.
That last comment on referring people to OHP, was that a condition of the waiver, OHP2? Was there concern on the part of CMS that Oregon would try and shift everybody into FEOP and dissuade them from going into the to Medicaid?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Britton, that's exactly right. We were required for a couple of reasons. First of all, anybody who comes into FEOP, we need to do what's a light screen, not a really heavy screen, of eligibility for Medicaid. And if they are Medicaid eligible, either the CHIP, for just general categorical Medicaid, then they have to receive the Title 19 funding as opposed to the Title 21 funding. The second thing is they wanted to ensure that we notified anybody that came into FEOP that they may be eligible for the state Medicaid or CHIP program. And so that's done through in the application process. If they're approved, we always give them information that they may want to pursue as to other eligibility. But the key on this benchmark is the higher that we can increase the number of people that actually get enrolled, the less administrative cost we incur. We don't have to do two approvals for every enrollment. I would rather do, 75% better in terms of instead of 50% of those people who actually get enrolled. The reason that the 2005 goal is at 75 is because we think we are doing a better job of following up. It drops a little bit in 206 and 207 because once we get to a 21,000 number of people enrolled, we will not have quite the staff capacity to do the kind of follow-up we do now. Everybody gets approved, gets a phone call, gets a letter. Do you need an agent? Do you need help? We try to do a lot of hand-holding to teach people how to utilize the private health insurance market. Number six, reduce FEOP administrative expenses as a percentage of total cost. Year one was startup. We always had been in the lower enrollment.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Senator Bates.
I'm not sure I quite understand that figure correctly. 20% to even 10% of cost of the program for administrative costs, is that against the total?
Fully matched amount?
I mean, what that figure really represents?
If I spend $20 million, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, if I spend $20 million in subsidy payments, $2 million of that will be administration.
You spend $80
million? Then 10% or $8 million of that will be administration.
Well, Mr. Chair, is that just your administrative cost?
That's just my administrative cost.
And there's administrative cost for the commercial insurance that's built under that.
It's built. That's included, Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, within the premium structure. It's not a part of our budget.
Why is this so high? I mean, it doesn't include commissions. It doesn't include any of the costs of the insurance company. That's all built into their premiums.
Mr. Chair, when you do eligibility, when you do redetermination, when you do the outreach, the training, this is a very similar administrative cost to what DHS or what the federal government allows on these programs. Now, I will tell you that if we didn't have to do eligibility, if people had just to pay a premium and, you know, sign up into the program on this form, my administrative cost would probably 1%. But that eligibility process, and I throw that figure out of my head without having any backup to it, but the point is the eligibility process, the redetermination, the outreach, the forms, the auditing, creates, you know, just like OHP Medicaid has an administrative cost attached to it.
Okay.
I should say the OMIP program's administrative cost, which includes both the insurance as well, we've got to about 6.7%.
Okay. Representative Henson.
Do you, thank you, Mr. Chair, do you verify eligibility? I mean, do you cross-check it with employment records or require payroll stubs or...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, going back to the eligibility question, we require payroll stubs for the last 3 months. We also require previous year's tax returns, not so you can verify income, but it just kind of gives you an information as to other incomes and assets people may have. We also have access to Employment Department wage records. We have access to DMV and to OHP, Oregon Health Plan, or DHS eligibility screen, so we can cross-check to see whether they're enrolled in plans there and what information they've provided to them. So we think we do a pretty good job on that. I mean, the best you can do, and then we do our audits. And for anybody who is self-employed, we require check registers, expense sheets. So we get a lot of information on self-employed individuals, whether they're janitors or house cleaners or whatever they may be.
Do you have on your audits? Do you have a like a certified error rate or a determination of your error rate in on eligibility?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, on our internal stuff we do. Right now, for example, every eligibility file that is worked by an eligibility worker is reviewed by an auditor. We do a double auditing right now. And part of that is we've had to bring on so many people so fast trying to get the program up that we're pushing staff to work hard, and they're doing a great job, but that means they're prone to making some mistakes. So we audit every eligibility file that's approved, and a certain percent, I want to say 1 out of 3 on declined, and also we audit 1 out of 3 on any declined ones to make sure that our eligibility folks are doing a pretty good job. We don't do any random audits right now, because right now we're just focused on those people coming into the program. Before, we would do random audits as well as targeted audits. A targeted audit is, and I believe eligibility work is a science, not an or an art, not a science, because these folks can look at a person's records and say something doesn't make sense. And when they do that, they give it to an auditor who can contact the person, do more questions, and, you know, what's this Jaguar, you know, doing here, whatever it may be. And then we have what we call random audits, where we just pick numbers, and the audit staff go and look at those just on a random basis. And again, much of it is feel. We have the information there. It's trying to read between the lines of everything to see if something comes up. We think the amount of fraud is very small. There is some. When we came before you and first established this program, we said that we wanted to keep the fraud level under 5%. We thought that would be great for the streamlining process. And we have found, I think, that it's much under 1%. And I don't know. I'm not sure what it is exactly, but it's very small.
Do you have access to information on these other state similar funds, similar programs that we could, you know, that you could let us kind of have a comparison to the administration costs? In other words, you know, these look high, but you're saying it's fairly normal for this kind of an eligibility. Well, other states, we have 31 other states that do this, and so I'd like to know if their percentages are also like this, or some representation of them.
Ms. Chair, just so we understand, OMIP administrative costs is separate from this. And when we talk about the 31 other states, that's high-risk pool. There are no other states that have okay. these subsidy programs.
Okay.
Okay, so there's really nothing to compare it to. And I concur with you that these administrative costs are too high. Let me talk a little bit about why they're high and what we're doing on it. First of all, you see the blip up there at, to the 19% for the current biennium. That's because we brought everybody on board and expanded our staff in July, because basically we have to put on between July of this last year and July of next year what we said we were going to put on over 24 months. So I've had to bring a whole bunch of folks on in starting July of this year to get my enrollment up. That doesn't get represented in subsidy payments until 3, 4 months, 5 months down the line. We're just starting to see that enrollment. Our, for example, in 2004, we show a 19.62. We're probably already at 16%. By the end of the biennium, we'll be back down to that 10 to 12% by the end of the biennium. But 10% is, I will tell you, is not an unusual figure, and we'll try to get you some additional information on that.
Now, am I correct that for subsidized health insurance, you're saying that ours is the only state in the union that does this?
The only state in the union, Mr. Chair, that is doing it like we do it. There are a few in Rhode Island, I believe Massachusetts, but they are structured very different than we are. Massachusetts actually subsidizes employers as well as individuals. And Rhode Island, it's really a takeoff of the Medicaid program to some degree and has not been too successful in getting enrollments in the group market. But we're probably one of the most successful of just what's called the premium subsidy or premium assistance programs.
Yeah. Thank you.
But, Mr. Chair, I want you to know I concur that the administrative cost, and I think I said this when we talked about the goals, so the one goal that I'm the most unhappy with is the administrative cost. I think the other thing I think it's important to note for us is we've put this as a performance measure. Very few agencies put administrative costs as performance measure. We put it out here because we think it's important. We think it's important to our clients and the advocates as well as those who fund the program. So we'll get that information for you.
Certainly.
Let's see. The remaining performance measures that we have there are ones that have been submitted to the Progress Board, and we're awaiting approval on, and that's relating to the customer service initiatives that all state agencies are required, and also the number of businesses that purchase the IPGB certified plan and the number of children that will enroll in that plan. I will tell you, I have no idea whether we're going to get 1 or 5,000 enrollments. And I think the legislature, when they passed this, I think there was agreement that we didn't know if this was going to work, but we wanted to make that effort because we knew the need was out there. So I caution you on these objectives. If I get 5,000 kids, I'll be really happy. If I get 2 kids, I will not be happy. And anything in between that, we'll have to debate whether it's good or bad. But those have been submitted to the Progress Board. We'll have more experience on those probably over the next 3 or 4 months to see how we're doing. Prioritized list is on the next sheet, page 20. We're kind of small, Mr. Chair. I mean, when you do some of the larger agencies, you take programs and you prioritize between programs. We're somewhat different because we really are just the two programs. There are no funds really that have been allocated towards the small employer health insurance plans. Those are just kind of assumed within our overall administration of the other two programs. So as we laid out these priority lists, there's really two priorities, the IPGB FEOP and the IPGB Information Education and Outreach. Within, though, however, the FEOP program, there are different levels of subsidy. And that's why we listed basically the first four priorities based on the level of subsidy, under 125%, 125 to 150, 170 to 185. Administration is listed as a priority because you can't do your program without the administration, but based on what decisions the legislature made, we would have to look at what the total cost of that administrative service would be. But basically, we would look at approximately the 10 to 12% level.
No, that's pretty straightforward.
Okay. And the two pages behind that just kind of lay out the those two different priorities by program area. On the next sheet we have, or the next section, which is the 10% reduction option. And I'll talk about that just briefly. The legislature has not looked at reducing the FEOP or IPGB budget based on anything other than total dollars. So our 10% reduction is basically applying that reduction to all of the programs and all the different priority levels on an equal basis. So we've taken the different subsidy levels and basically just applied the 10% reduction to them. We believe in basically not setting priorities in the current environment, whether you have an income of 170 over somebody who has 160. It is too difficult to manage that. FPL is only a guide. It's really not an indicator of either need or sometimes resources available to folks. So the 10% reduction option really is against the total dollars, and then the same but no change in the eligibility requirements.
How does it affect the maintenance of effort requirement that you referred to earlier?
The reduction, any reduction in the governor's recommended budget would put us under the maintenance of effort requirement and put us in a position of negotiating at some point with the federal government to either pay back federal dollars that were expended. It would put potentially the larger demonstration project in jeopardy, or it could cause them to pull away their support from the program.
Okay, Mr. Britton.
Rocky, I just want to clarify, and maybe with Becky as well, on the maintenance of effort, The Information, Education, and Outreach General Fund, is that part of the maintenance?
It is not part of the maintenance effort, Mr. Chair.
If that were reduced, that would not affect the maintenance of effort.
That is correct.
Likewise, the admin support, or the staffing and the services and supplies, that's also not part of the maintenance of effort, or is?
Mr. Chair,
it is not.
Okay. Part of the maintenance of effort.
So there's some, perhaps, flexibility in those two pieces of the budget. But if it's used as a subsidy for FEOP, that counts for the maintenance of effort, and that's what's the issue is.
The only caution, Mr. Chair, Mr. Britton, would be that to the degree that you decrease administration or the marketing and information and outreach so you can't get the applicants in,
right,
you can impact the ability to meet maintenance of effort.
Okay. Thank you. Questions, comments, things that you'd like to know more about before we terminate the rest of this meeting? We can adjourn. All right, thank you. It's been very effective. Mr. Britton?
One final comment, members, and that is tomorrow, House Bill 5006, which is the Commission for the Blind. Deborah Manthe is the LFO staff person, and she has handed out agency presentation materials to all of you. So you need to bring those tomorrow.
What was it, 5006?
House Bill 5006, Commission for the Blind.
3:30, Mr. Chair.
3:30. Thank you very much. We appreciate your permission, and with that, we'll be adjourned.
Rocky.